It's been years since I thought about Mr. Hernandez, but that doesn't make the memories any less special or the part he played in my life any less important. Mr. Hernandez ran my very first computer store. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to William Hearn, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. People are very hung up on firsts, and especially being the first. There was a long-ago Usenet thread I was exposed to where somebody talked about running the first computer store, and they gave a date, and then others contested that date, and he just kept changing the rules by which he was the first computer store, the first one to sell software only, the first one to sell software of a certain type. And frankly, who cares? Computer stores, when they started to arrive, changed everything for people who wanted to try out these new toys. Previously, you were talking about ads in electronics magazines and science magazines that could promise all sorts of important things revolving around the computer's operation, but then getting the thing in your home was a different matter entirely. In the 1970s era of the kit computer or even the early microcomputers, you needed help. These were not intuitive machines. Just the fact that a soldering iron was needed to change whether they could do lowercase or have more memory tells you what we were dealing with. It was cheaper in some cases to just get a big pile of parts inside of a plastic bag mailed to you from Arizona or New Mexico or California. Then came the endless weekends of hoping that you did everything right and followed all the directions. Computers that came in plastic cases with well-written, professionally printed manuals quickly took over as something a family would want to try to get into this new computer thing everyone was talking about. In this era of hobbyists and engineers colliding with families and businesses, I turned 9 to 10, witnessed my parents getting divorced, and ultimately moved to Brewster, New York. Computers and software, the magazines and the promises were just what I needed at that time. They were escape. They were an assurance that it wasn't as bad and gray as it all felt to me at that time. By writing out to magazines like Creative Computing and Compute, I was able to get mailings sent to me promising me the world. It's why I kept them all these years and scanned many of them in. But it's one thing to encounter these promises as a kid and another to see them right in front of you as they were meant to be. Computers were filtering in here and there. There was a mall that I would go to, the Duchess Mall, and there were computers here and there, the service merchandise, the Radio Shack, each one allowing me to play with them, type on them, and look at the prices and realize I couldn't afford a thing. It was like a little treasure hunt for me, walking down that mall, walking past clothing stores that had no interest to me and food that I wasn't interested in eating, to be able to walk into this display of technology that would let me ultimately escape. In Brewster, I lived on a house that was walking distance from the main street. This was a town that had gone through many different changes. At the time, if you squinted, you could see the history of the town, the turn-of-the-century growth, the 30s and 40s splendor and Main Street with its thoroughfare, and then here in the 80s, see the layer of grime and forgetfulness that told you that perhaps the glory days were well past. The bars were always open. The main downtown diner was going to be there forever. But there weren't a whole lot of boutiques anymore. This wasn't going to be a promenade of the townspeople sharing their finest. Since I was so close to town, I would walk up and down it, seeing what was going on and taking an unhealthy amount of interest in the phone system and central office, as well as just seeing where things led and the kind of aimless wandering a preteen might engage in. A store opened, and to my greatest delight, I discovered it was going to sell computers. I have the strongest memory of walking in there. A bland but newly installed carpet, a number of shelves all along the walls, and a table along a side that had a cash register. And behind it was this smiling man, just the most incredible toothy smile and wide eyes, who was delighted to have the bell ring on his door and have a kid walk in. I mean, here I was, so obviously not the kind of customer one would need for computers. I didn't have any money. Withdrawn, introverted, yet lured in because here was box after box on the wall of the very promises I was being given inside of magazines. His name was Mr. Hernandez. And this was his shop. I never met anybody else who ran it with him. I think it was a sole proprietorship. I wish I could say that I knew a lot about him, his past, his age. I just didn't. At the time, I wasn't inquisitive about people. People were kind of scary to me. They were unpredictable. They did things I didn't expect. I felt shy and concerned around them. I never knew what was going to happen next around a person. Computers made sense. If you typed 10 and print, and you typed run, it would print. Every time. Every single time. Until you turned the power off. It's funny, looking back, the kind of front you want to put on. I didn't know any way of dealing with a person of this age who was interested in the things I was. But Mr. Hernandez was truly a shopkeeper. He was friendly. He answered my questions. I remember the walks I would take through his store. The memory I have of software coming in baggies with a floppy disk and a printed manual come from Mr. Hernandez's store. Companies that themselves were just starting out used to put their software not in colored boxes because that was very expensive, but instead would buy actual baggies and by hand, the same creators, the same programmers who had made the game, would place them inside of bags and then ship them in unit sizes of 5 to 10 programs off to stores all over the country. They'd put a price on it, $15, $25, and then hope for the best. It was in Mr. Hernandez's store that I first saw Adventure International. It was the first place I saw things from Online Systems, later Sierra Online. It was a place that I saw Peachtree Accounting and IBM products. He sold all manner of software and hardware for the Atari, for the Apple, for the PC, for the Commodore, and always, always ready to have a conversation. The rules of the conversation of a preteen talking to somebody who's running a business should be pretty clear. They can talk with you as long as they can, but if a real customer, in quotes, comes into the store, you gotta shut up. You gotta sit over by the side and look like you have something very important to do with a box, because the person with the real money is coming in and may buy something, making the store live for another month. I didn't understand rent or insurance or making deals with distributors or companies. None of that came up. All I remember was that in one small alcove of this terrible little dying town, there was a man who had placed his mark, who was trying to have a business that would persist and grow, and do it, of all things, by selling software and hardware, microcomputers. I only bought a couple things from that store over the years, and I remember all of them. One thing I bought was the game Preppy for the Atari 800 by Adventure International, created by Russ Wetmore. I was impressed by the fact that it was 100% machine language and that it used all four channels of my Atari, and it would be a game that was arcade quality. To be able to play this game, I had to purchase a Wico joystick, the only good joystick to buy, made by a manufacturer who made professional-grade joysticks. At the time, my Atari 800 at home only had a cassette drive. This meant that I was buying a tape from Mr. Hernandez that said Preppy on it, along with a color insert drawn by somebody named Ross and telling you that this game was going to be the greatest thing ever. It's 40 years now. I don't even know how many people remember the whole Preppy thing, where somebody had written a book about how to be a prep school kid, and it had taken off, and the Preppy archetype raged on for a number of years. The idea that people had names like Muffy and wore plaid skirts and were really into Izod alligator logos on their shirts, hobnobbed with the rich and one day would be rich themselves. I assure you, this was a big enough thing that making a game based on it made some sort of sense. The game cost about $30, and it took me weeks to scrounge up money from my mom to take change from being sent out on errands and sock it away, or being given a few dollars here and there and then not spending it all. Just slowly building a small dragon hoard to get up to $30 to proudly walk over to Mr. Hernandez's shop and graduate from mere onlooker, from annoying kid, to a true customer. I have a strong memory of assembling a lot of quarters on his counter and him patiently waiting for me to be done. Preppy was everything I had hoped it would be. After loading for 12 or 15 minutes on this cassette drive, I could play a real arcade game on my Atari with my professional-grade joystick. I was in heaven. A part of me wanted to make games like this, but without anyone around me to guide me, I didn't learn machine language. I only sort of understood how sprites worked on the Atari 800. I knew it involved binary and doing strange calculations with a grid. That never went anywhere. The second game that I bought from Mr. Hernandez's shop was a game that was made by Avalon Hill. And it involved a war game, a war simulation. Something about the box really told me that I was going to play something special. It indicated a simulation of war and wargaming and strategy, and that keeping track of armies and keeping them fed and which weapons needed to be restocked, I would have an incredible time reliving some 1940s warfare. And here's something funny that happened. I got that game home. I opened it up. It was full of perforated cardboard tokens that would represent different kinds of machinery and men. And you were to put it on a map that was included and then use the program to guide yourself. And frankly, it was too much for me. Absolutely too much for me to process. I did not understand what I was looking at. Here were all of these different parts you had to move around. It wasn't in any way something I could work with, a game that I could play. But here's the funny part. I didn't return it. I didn't bring up that I didn't understand it. I just enjoyed it. I had it around my bedroom. I had taken some of the cardboard out. I had it around the room. And I had booted it a couple times. It just became a part of the things in my room, a part of having a flashlight or posters and an ashtray and a plate and other things that I had dragged out of the rest of the house and the surrounding town. It was just an artifact, a meaningless yet meaningful part of my environment. The final thing I bought from Mr. Hernandez's store was a Scott Adams adventure. I remember that it came in a package, but looking back again, the package was something that quickly went out of favor. It was also a cassette tape, but the cassette tape was inside of styrofoam. So the packaging was actually a color cardboard wrapping around styrofoam that had a cassette tape inside of it. The minute you opened it, crumbs of styrofoam got everywhere. But inside, loading from this cassette tape, was a real adventure game, one which changed the font on my Atari and then encouraged me to walk around a building, look for things to pick up, and try to figure out all of the different adventures. I never solved that game. It sounds strange to hear, but I was never very good at these games. The only reason I'd solved the original adventure was because my cousin Mark had helped me. I didn't have the mind for it. I couldn't make that final leap without getting some sort of help or somebody telling me what to do. So I never completed the game, but I sure enjoyed getting those points that I did get after loading it up for minutes and minutes after school. These three games and Mr. Hernandez's store gave me what I needed to get through those years. They gave me a sense that there was something out there, that no matter how poor the horizon looked, there was something beyond it that I had not yet seen, and it was well worth it to stick around and make an effort because I was going to see what that was. Years later, it's snowing, and I am in a hotel in Wisconsin, and it's obvious that my car is not going to be able to go anywhere. This is bad. I am going to be doing an interview that is critical to my documentary about text adventures, and I can't hope to get there. I was sliding out of control just getting to the hotel. Luckily, when I called Scott Adams, he told me he had a truck that could make it, and he came by and picked me up with my equipment, and we went back to his farm. I interviewed Scott Adams for about an hour of tape. We talked about all the manner of running Adventure International, about what he was trying to do with his adventures, what led him to think this was fun, what made him think a business in software was what he wanted to try. I used a lot of that footage in the documentary, and it was strange to think of this being the person who had written the games that I had loaded as a kid to give me such escape, that he was now listening to me and I could ask him any question in the world and he would do his best to answer it. It's a thrill that always drove me in these documentary interviews, and I did not walk away disappointed. He put everything into those answers. He gave clarity and context. 10 years after that, the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, decided to do a display on Adventure International because Scott Adams had given them all of his archives. Among the items in this display case was a TRS-80 computer that had been modified to have a regular television monitor in it, and they were playing, in a loop, answers to questions I had asked Scott Adams 10 years earlier. They combined them all into him talking about Adventure International's goals and what he was trying to accomplish. They had it on a loop, and when Scott Adams came to visit, it turned out this was the first time he had actually seen anything from the film. For me, there was a bright line from Scott Adams standing in front of an interview from 10 years previous, and then me standing at that interview thinking about the first time that I held Adventure International games in my hand in that computer store in Brewster, New York, with Mr. Hernandez smiling and encouraging me to be a part of this growing revolution. Mr. Hernandez, at one point, asked me if I wanted to take on a little project that he could pay me for. Naturally, I said yes. He provided me with a long printout of a computer program written in BASIC. It was an inventory control system that he was going to use for the store. The idea was I could use my skills in programming to improve it, to make it better, and he could then use it to make his store better. I'll tell you straight out, I completely flaked on this. At that point, I was 13. I was deep in depression. I was able to communicate with people, but not in the way most people think of with me. I didn't know how to work with this code. To me, it was complicated, involved. It was able to handle problems that I hadn't even thought of, and it used parts of the BASIC language that I didn't understand. It was, in other words, too much for me. My solution was just to avoid the store, to look over at that printout in my room and think about if I could do something with it, and realizing I couldn't, really lacking the tools to be able to tell him. Ultimately, he dropped it. It didn't come up in conversation again. I hope in my heart he was in the same way I would be, to say, this kid tried, but it was obviously a bit much. This 13-year-old, he's just not going to be able to rewrite this inventory control system for me. I better do it myself. Mr. Hernandez ultimately moved that store to a part of town where the stores faced in a different direction, were closer to the highway. I walked through it once, visiting him, but life was changing for me very quickly. Brewster was not going to be a part of my life anymore. And so, for me, Mr. Hernandez faded away. My relationship to computers changed. Having a modem, being able to call bulletin board systems, and being able to download software that way took away my need to add up pennies and quarters and buy software off a shelf. I was getting shareware programs and enjoying them and making games of my own and trying to submit them to constant rejection, but never being daunted by it. Living in later towns and going to college, every once in a while, in a moment of quiet, I'd remember that there was a store in my past, that there was this man with a universally beautiful smile who encouraged me to walk around, to window shop, to take these interesting baubles, these toys, these electronic wonders and promises, and imagine myself being a part of them. I've tried to find out what happened to Mr. Hernandez, what happened to his store, what happened to him, but I've never found it. All I can do is honor his memory, to thank him here for what he made me into, the bridge he gave me, and maybe, just for a short time, live in your head as well. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to James Bekoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Forrest Fuqua, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. Believe it or not, in my storage unit is my original copy of Preppy, my original copy of that Avalon Hill game, and my original Scott Adams adventure. I've moved most of my software to archives, to other storage locations, but I have a feeling these are going to stick with me for some time to come.